From the KTO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. Indigenous women and girls are murdered or disappear from American cities in alarming numbers, but no one knows the true scope of the problem because no one regularly reports the data. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin tells us about one effort to spotlight both problems, the homicides of Native women and the lack of data collection about their deaths and disappearance. And she reports Anchorage plays a special role.
At the U.S. Capitol, at a press conference about missing and murdered Indigenous women, Senator Lisa Murkowski wore purple because she said that was the favorite color of Ashley Johnson Barr.
Ashley was 10 years old when she was brutally, brutally murdered in Kotzebue after being kidnapped.
Murkowski also spoke about Sophie Sergi, a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks who was raped and murdered in a dormitory bathroom.
That has been a cold case now for some 25 years.
She says such stories never leave her, but they do often drop out of the public record or never make it into the record in the first place. Murkowski and Senator Heidi Heitkamp have sponsored a bill to improve federal data collection on Native American homicide victims. Heitkamp, a North Dakota Democrat, says information is the first step.
You will never solve a problem you won't admit you have, that you don't have data on, that you don't have the ability to actually analyze.
The Urban Indian Health Institute highlights the lack of data in a new report. Institute researchers contacted police departments in 71 cities, Orlando to Utqiagvik, and asked them to provide case information on all missing and murdered Indigenous women, going back to 1900. 31 police departments provided no data at all or didn't respond by the report deadline. The researchers also combed social and traditional media and reached out to community members. Ultimately, they found 506 cases in the 71 cities. They say it's a data snapshot.
First, I want to tell you I had no federal funding for this. I financed most of it myself through speaking fees that I charge. Thank you, everybody who pays.
Abigail Echohawk is one of the report authors. She lives in Seattle now, but she's originally from Fairbanks.
I did this report for less than $20,000, when the Department of Justice, the FBI, states, cities told us that they couldn't do it. There wasn't budget line items. They didn't have the resources.
The report singles out the Anchorage Police for excellence. The authors say APD saw the request for data as important and got on it promptly. The Anchorage Police Department found 31 cases of missing or murdered Native women. And the hero of that statistical mission is Sergeant Slav Markowitz of APD's homicide unit.
I try to maintain good databases.
Markowitz has been devoted to those databases since he started in homicide in 2005. And he got help from detectives in culling back through the old files.
All the way to 1970s. And it was difficult, and we were afraid that it may not be complete, but we tried to gather to get all those cases listed.
Markowitz says when APD started the database, there was resistance to collecting information on victim race. The police should be colorblind, the argument went, because all homicide victims are important.
I still wanted to have that information included because I knew that when you have that information, you can adjust your strategies. Not only in order to solve these crimes, but also to hopefully prevent them.
Markowitz is retiring at the end of the year, but says he's confident his successor will keep up the devotion to good data collection. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
It's common to hear public officials say that Alaska Natives join the armed forces at the highest rates in the country. Here's Robert Wilkie, Secretary for the Department of Veterans Affairs, addressing the Alaska Federation of Natives last month.
You serve in the military of the United States at a higher rate than any group of Americans.
During World War II and for decades after, American Indians and Alaska Natives did indeed volunteer for the armed forces at exceptionally high rates. But that's dropped over time. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, a big part of that change has to do with transformations in the structure of the military.
Growing up in New Stoyahawk, 24-year-old Lawrence Gust never planned on signing up for the Alaska Army National Guard.
From my village, it's not really been a thing for anyone to join the military, so it wasn't, you know, anything for younger children to look up to.
He says recent wars overseas have left many parents in the region worried about the dangers of enlisting. But Gust encountered recruiters from the National Guard during a school trip to Dillingham and says that planted the idea of joining the Guard as a way to help pay for college, get training, and travel. Now, 3 years since enlisting, he's part of a group of young people from New Stuyahok in the Guard.
Recruiters and stuff are now like traveling out to villages and giving presentations and things like that and sparking an interest in, you know, the younger kids at home. Really, the National Guard just needed to be heard from in the villages.
Gust is exactly who the state wants as it tries to rebuild the shrunken National Guard presence off the road system. A rural engagement program has been underway for the last few years, meant to draw on both veterans living in the bush as well as younger residents, more like how Alaska's National Guard was in the past.
It was very common to see fatigues and the bunny boots anywhere out on the bush.
Michelle Spark grew up in the southwestern communities of Bethel and Chivac and has been part of policy discussions on the Guard in the legislature. In the past, residents in rural regions joined the military in large numbers. Part of the draw for many residents was the organization's roots in Alaska's storied territorial guard during World War II. The organization's structure and mission kept folks in state rather than activating them for faraway assignments, which, Spark says, made military service more convenient.
It was pretty easy for people to sign up for the National Guard because it kind of fit our subsistence way of life. You had schedules and training that were kind of intermittent, so you could still go back home and commit to subsistence and providing for your families.
A number of things have since changed. The size of Alaska's Army National Guard has shrunk by half since the 90s and is now more concentrated along the road system. And in 2006, Alaska Guardsmen were activated for the first time since World War II, deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, something Spark says was a jolt for rural families.
I think that kind of changed the culture a little bit about people committing, making that kind of commitment to the government.
We had a strong National Guard. I mean, we had armories in most of our villages across the state. It was not uncommon to go into a village and have most of the people involved with the Alaska Army National Guard.
Verdi Bowen directs the state's Office of Veterans Affairs and grew up in rural southeast Alaska before joining the Air Force. Bowen knows the state's veteran population well and says he couldn't offer definitive verification that Alaska Natives still serve at the highest rates in the country. But current data from the Census Bureau, Department of Veterans Affairs, and Defense Department suggests that that long-held claim is no longer true. A steep decline in Alaska Native rates of service isn't only due to changes in the state's National Guard, but the military overall. The armed forces have become more selective. The Army, for example, has much higher enlistment standards than it did in 1969. That's the year a judge in Fairbanks gave Benno Cleveland a choice between jail or the infantry.
Yeah, I was a little rambunctious when I was a younger man, yeah.
Cleveland did two tours in the Mekong Delta during the height of the Vietnam War, receiving two Purple Hearts. And he says the Army was good for him. It was a way to see different parts of the world, and he found that the training emphasized many of the same values he knew from his Inupiaq heritage.
It's the same thing as any culture. Our elders, they've taught us. They've taught us to be good, to be respectful, to work for what we want, to help other people.
Cleveland credits the combination of his indigenous culture, the military community, and faith with helping him make it through years of struggle to process his combat experience. Today, he wears regalia mixed with indigenous icons and military insignia. Even amid sweeping changes in the armed forces, he thinks they offer young Alaska Natives a similar set of opportunities for advancement and service to lands where indigenous people have long lived.
This is our home. Our people have been here forever.
Whether military institutions can find new ways to fit that will to serve with the needs of Alaska Native communities remains to be seen. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Governor-elect Mike Dunleavy today announced a key member of his cabinet. Corey Feige will be Alaska's next Natural Resources Commissioner. Feige is not new to the agency she will now lead. She was previously the head of DNR's Division of Oil and Gas under Governor Bill Walker. But she resigned in 2016 during a dispute between the Walker administration and oil companies over marketing North Slope gas. Feige is a geophysicist and engineer by training and has previously worked for small oil and mining companies in Alaska. Governor-elect also made a policy announcement. Dunleavy says he wants to freeze all new regulations across all state departments. Weather, 43 degrees, light rain right now at Juneau International Airport.